This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. So you're sitting at an airport or a cafe and you see somebody reading a book. And you sneak a peek at the cover and you form an opinion about the reader. And it may be true that the novel would tell you something about the person who's reading it. Nancy Armstrong sees it a little differently. More than just reflecting who we are, she thinks a novel in some ways makes us who we are. Nancy Armstrong is a literary critic and a professor at Duke. She edits the journal Novel, a forum on fiction, and she's organized a conference at Duke this weekend that examines a new set of novels that are written with a global audience in mind. Nancy Armstrong joins me now. Welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much. I'm so happy to be here.
You know, in the Academy, there's this kind of accepted vision of the novel having risen with the nation state. They emerged at the same time. So break that down for us. What does that mean, if that's true?
Well, now it's almost the commonplace has become almost a litmus test as we, you know, as we watch different nations emerge as such across the world. We say they're not really a nation, or they have become a nation once they have their own national novel. And what this means is that novels set a sort of standard for belonging to a community and the kind of person you have to be to belong to that community. And some of us think, I mean, we're called cultural constructionists, and there are all sorts of names for it. But basically, it's that, you know, we don't imagine this form of identity until it's presented to us. We have to have, you know, especially if you're dealing with a wide diversity of people, you have to have some sort of national character to imagine yourself becoming. That's basically, if I could boil it down, that's basically what it is. And novels not only produce that character, but give you a kind of ideal roadmap for becoming one.
And in a sense, though, the writer doesn't have this in mind. It's not their objective to make you a little more British or a little more American. And
I'm not sure about that. I mean, we see, I mean, James Joyce wants to make you a little more Irish than British, I would say. The Americans want to make you American and not just sort of an exiled Brit. You know, across the Anglophone world, you know, my specialty, we see the nation. I guess what it is, it's a sort of Woody Allen thing. If you're not in the country club, okay, if you're not British, you have to imagine yourself as almost British in a characteristic way that gives you kind of national dignity or positive value rather than simply not being British.
So if we see it the other way around, a novel like Huckleberry Finn, again, kind of a traditional, the quintessential, some say, American novel. It bisects the country. We get a cross-section as we go down the Mississippi. Not a reflection of what he sees, but in fact, in many ways, a reinforcement of what it means to be American. And yeah, you're not British if you're in this picture.
No, it is. It's not a reflection. It's hilariously not a reflection. I mean, what it is, it's a digestion and abjection, rejection, and remodeling of every stereotype known to the American popular reader. And, you know, we have Tom Sawyer there. He's the good one, right? Or he's bad in acceptable ways. And he's going, excuse me, he's going to end up, you know, in a fine American household modeled on, you know, the British novelistic standard, whereas Huckleberry Finn is going to keep on moving and definitely rejects that kind of standard. And he's the one who's considered ex-American.
So and these standards, and particularly the standard for what is a family, the Adam of the novel, is crucial to understanding the trajectory of the novel over time. Right, how that changes, how they're depicted in novels, is a pretty good idea of what's going on in any given time.
I would say that the family, especially in the British tradition, is the model of community. John Locke, who sort of started it all off in the early 18th century, suggested that the man who had a household and dependents and children whom he knew were his own, was like a little monarch. I mean, this is the beginning of what we call individual self-sovereignty, this sort of possessive obsession we have with ruling our own private lives. It's still very much with us. So the household is, in Locke's fantasy life, the basic unit of modern liberal society.
How is the, can you tell us how the U.S., the American novel emerged, or U.S. identity emerged through novels?
Oh, I wish I could. I'll take a crack at it.
Yeah.
Okay. The American novel has to be American, but it also has to be a novel. It wants a literature. And it wants the literature of the United States, the new United States, to be basically English or British. It doesn't want it to be French or African or any of the other possibilities. It doesn't want it to be an ethnic novel. It wants it to be British, but it also wants it to be American. So this is the problem that American novelists have had unto the present day, actually. In fact, 9/11 gave the Civil War, I would say, and 9/11 gave America a way of being, American novelists, a way of being distinctively American, because these were wounds that Europe didn't feel.
And now we're looking at the global novel that is really in many ways undermining all of those structures that had come to be supported until now.
I would say this is I'm going to move from your previous question to this one. I would say that the American novel is still less global than many others. And perhaps because of the 9/11 wound being so formative and so such an American trauma, we have not been able to think of it as a world trauma. So I don't think that we have world novelists of the caliber of J.M. Coetzee or Amitav Ghosh or Rushdie or any, I mean, can you think of anyone like that? I can't.
Well, we'll talk about that, the challenge of going global in a world that is maybe leaving without us. Maybe our isolation is finally catching up with us. My guest, Nancy Armstrong, English professor at Duke, editor of Novel, a Formal Fiction. Just ahead, we will talk about novel and globalization on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking with Nancy Armstrong, a scholar, professor, and editor. She's here to talk about the future of the novel and a conference this weekend, A Novel World, at Duke. How has globalization changed the novel, or has it?
We were talking earlier about how the novel prepares the individual or allows the individual, the reader, to imagine himself as an individual ending up in a family with some kind of a position within society. And what the novel now is doing is giving us a sense of all the people who are left out of that fantasy, who are on the other side of the normal or the literate, or the people who can entertain this fantasy.
You've written that rather than putting up a traditional defense of the family and individual, these newer novels, these global novels, participate in an international effort to imagine life after the family as both livable and dignified.
That sounds really smart.
That's something you may have written.
I did. The interesting thing is that these novelists, someone like Rushdie or Ghosh or J.M. Coetzee or Ishiguro or David Mitchell, can entertain you by allowing you to participate in or imagine a community that is not like you. Okay, it's sort of beyond identification, I think, is the key thing. Yes, we love reading a novel and identifying with Jane Eyre and imagining her triumphs as our triumphs. These novels take us on the other side of that normative line, to the abnormal or the rejected, all of which are imagined as non-individual. Humanity that it doesn't is not made up of individuals much like ourselves.
And so can we find ourselves, can we reimagine ourselves if we go back to our original premise that we actually draw our identities from the novel, it's not the other way around, start to imagine ourselves in this new global world?
Well, first we have to see the limits of the individual. Okay, we have to see that it is a kind of prophylactic encasement of our humanity, and that it's very fragile and not everyone has one. It's not natural. So I think imagining the limitations of that form of identity is the first step, to see it as artificial. And then to see all the fabulous possibilities for community, the horrible possibilities of biological disaster that we will inevitably share with the rest of humanity if we don't start seeing the world this way.
Is this a kind of reimagining of, say, Kafka's Metamorphosis? What was a horror to us is now a reality, and we find that, oh, it's not so terrifying to reimagine ourselves not as a particular individual but as related to others in ways we hadn't imagined.
A novel like Ishiguro's Never Let Me Go, which is, I cite that one because it's so popular. It's both popular and literary, and now it's a movie, bad movie, but still a movie. And what Ishiguro does there is to suck the reader in and have us identify with Kathy the clone, even though she doesn't have a real name. She's Kathy H. And until we start to see, we realize that we are the very people who exclude her and condemn her to supply body parts to keep our unique individuality going. So the novel will take you to the other side of the liberal, social, familial line.
Can American writers, do you think, participate fully in this, given our ability to stay so isolated and so insulated?
I have to say that I don't really see it. I don't see the kind of thing. I think our writers still write for America and not for the world. And yes, you have to be a certain kind of cosmopolitan person with that kind of rich linguistic and cultural experience. And I do think many of our writers have that. But I don't think they imagine their community as a global community. And I don't think you can represent the community that way and the conditions of belonging, what you have to do to belong to a world community, unless you are writing for the world.
Well, and maybe unless you have to. I mean, I'm thinking about writers from post-colonial countries who simply have to be part of that other world in order to participate at all. In fact, in order to really continue their education, not quite true for Americans. So you aren't forced to be a global citizen if you're an American, and you can still kind of get by, right?
Well, many post-colonial writers don't like the idea of, you know, losing indigenous cultures. They want to hang on to, they want to have the same kind of national specificity, national identity that an American or a British novelist has and can write for. So yes, they're forced, but many of them are forced kicking and screaming. And I don't think they are, I mean, there's a new generation now. It took several generations of post-colonial writers to get to the stage we can call the global novel or the world novel. The first were intent on making a national tradition of this that was equivalent to England or the United States. Mm. So we have someone like Orhun Pamuk in Turkey, who is probably the first Turkish world novelist. And I don't know that much about this, so I could be overlooking some very worthy person. But he faced enormous censorship in his own country because he was violating certain he included Sufism, certain kinds of religious traditions in a novel that was secular Marxist. So, you know, this was not this mixture of what they called din and devlet was, you know, it pissed everybody off.
So if we're not individuals, if you say we're sort of ensconced in this sheath that once it's removed, we see we're not quite the individual that we'd come to understand ourselves. Are we still connected? Are we what species are we? And do novels define that? Do they make an attempt to tell us what we are if we're not that?
I think that the topic you're bringing up is one that's really hot stuff in the academy now. And I think this cuts across the sciences. And I think, you know, real people and, you know, everybody is interested. It's called affect. And instead of individual feelings, you know, do you love your mother? Do you love your sister? Based on a familial matrix, emotional matrix, I think we're moving towards something that has to do with the body's desire to survive, what it needs and desires, and can it recognize those needs and desires in other human beings? And this is not the warm, fuzzy, you're like me kind of feeling that we get from Jane Eyre or Jane Austen. Not at all. It's a really harsh awakening to feel in the middle of the novel that we're all in the same boat. And it's a perilous voyage. The biosphere we inhabit is threatened.
Well, we're all in the same boat, but not each in the same boat in that sense.
Yeah, but I mean, I think we see with every time there's some new brand of flu, swine flu or whatever it was, norovirus this year, people that part of people that recognizes what they share with the rest of humanity, their species being, their species consciousness rises to the fore. They want some of that. You know, they realize that they are not insulated individuals. The condition of humanity is their condition as well.
So terrorism is a subject then.
Terrorism goes after that consciousness and is partly responsible. Absolutely, you're absolutely right about that. Terrorism and now terrorism as opposed to a national enemy.
Right. And so then the national literature of America that looks at this wound as our personal insult and perhaps fails to understand some of the deeper connections, the interconnections that make this kind of response possible, likely, inevitable, gives us a different kind of literature here, I guess.
Right. If you compare our 9/11 novels to something like Ian McEwan's Saturday, I think you'll understand the difference.
So break that down for us.
Okay, McEwan's novel Saturday, popular novel, literary novel, begins with a man standing at his window watching a plane go down and burst into flames outside of London. And it makes him think of 9/11 and that this could be something like that. That's a kind of consciousness of the world right there. That you have nothing like that in American literature.
How about the effect of all of this on our understanding of the novel itself or the structure of the novel? Terms like narration, plot, point of view, character, do they apply anymore? Do we even have the same vocabulary to discuss the novel?
That's a really good question. We have narrative, okay, but narrative doesn't move toward the establishment of a family or some form of success over one's rivals. So it doesn't move toward that state of being we call happiness that we've been promised that we pursue traditionally in this country. It's written into our founding documents, right?
You have a constitutional responsibility to be happy. No, you must be.
But you have a right to pursue it.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So novels no longer have that kind of endpoint or teleology or goal. Okay, they, you know, the it's more as if narrative is about how you continue as you are, or can you? You know, what kinds of contingencies, combinations, recombinations will your group go through, and will it last? So it's a very, very different, and this is partly responsible for the different kind of affect.
So does the novel have a future, given our now the sort of rise in visual storytelling? It's, do we need the novel, and does it have a future?
Well, I don't know if we need it. I don't know if we've ever needed it. I think that the novel is responsible for making us need it. In other words, it creates a kind of demand. It's, it comes into being with capitalism, and it's part of the book market.
Are we going to move to just a strictly kind of visual storytelling universe?
I don't think so. When I take plane rides, sometimes I just got back from California on the red eye, and the cabin was aglow with Kindles. So new media and the novel are not opposed. They are not sibling rivals, as some people represent. I think Second Life isn't where you have an avatar. You go into this virtual world. You set up your home. You can get married. This is novelistic thinking. So it may not be a novel that you can hold in your hand like this, but it is novelistic thinking.
Tell us what's going to happen at the conference this weekend.
This weekend we're going to have three fabulous keynote speakers, one of whom is a world novelist, Amitav Ghosh, who's giving his talk, and it's open to the public on Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock, 4 to 6. And
what's he going to be talking about?
He's going to be talking about how he makes a world novel. He's you know, an expert archivist and anthropologist. And so it's a public talk, and it's available to people, but it's also a scholar's talk because it talks about all, you know, how much work it takes to produce a fictional world. And then there are about 150 scholars from all over the world who are here to talk about the novel.
Well, and tell us, too, about the Society for Novel Studies.
This is a society of people who are responding in many ways to the questions you asked me. The importance of the novel now, what is changing, what has been changing in the 21st century, what does it mean for us as human beings? How is it going to reshape our identities? What are going to be the conditions of belonging to a community? What's going to happen to the nation? That kind of thing. And all the panels are arranged around those topics rather than around nations or centuries or particular authors, which we think are rather obsolete categories.
Nancy, pleasure talking with you. Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Nancy Armstrong is the Gilbert Lewis and Edward Lehrman Professor of English at Duke University. She edits the journal Novel, a forum on fiction. The conference, Novel Worlds, is happening in town this weekend, and you are invited to the keynote address tomorrow at 4 p.m. at the Nasher Museum. Coming up next, opera is in town. Stay tuned.